look at my watch, so let me put this here. I'm sorry, there aren't seats. There's a couple of places to sit here, and the second row has some spaces. So if there's any, if anyone thinks your row can squeeze in another one, could you let someone sit?
Yes, you are actually.
There's one more spot in the front row if anybody needs it. First couple rows have space. The first couple rows on left and right have space. There you go. So I'll go ahead and get started. It might take a while for you all to settle down. You seem like kind of a wild bunch, so you might never settle, so I'm just going to dive in. It's really a delight to be here. I have come many times, and I always enjoy it very much. I see many familiar and many new faces. I love the prayer that Don began with. It was of universal spirit and its sentiment about planting seeds of wisdom in our mind that will grow in our heart and bear fruit in our hands is a sentiment that I completely concur with, and I thank you for starting off with a quiet prayer like that. So I'm going to give some offerings today from the Buddhist tradition, which is my own heart tradition. I've been a devout Buddhist since my early 20s, although I was raised Christian, Episcopal, and I have deep respect for the Christian tradition. I'm a practicing Buddhist now. And so I hope that some of you, whether Christian or not, will find some of the offerings that I share today from the Buddhist tradition helpful. I'm also, by the way, as an academic, on a board of a society, and I'll meet in 2 weeks in Atlanta at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Religion with the board of the Society for Buddhist Christian Studies. And as a board member there, I help to put out the journal, to talk about how to spread the word of people who are interested in studying both traditions. Many of the people on the board actually are Christians who practice Buddhist meditation and deepen their life through Buddhism. But then there are many like myself who are Buddhist, and while I don't see myself as a practicing Christian, I actually find the wells of Christian faith deep, and they nurture my ways of thinking and being, I think in ways that I can't even see. And I love that very much. I'm going to talk a little bit today about, I can't remember what the title of the talk was supposed to be, but something about cultivating compassion from a Buddhist perspective. And I'm going to give some introductory comments, and then I'm going to point to this text that I've given you, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that text in a moment. I mean, you need to, while I'm talking, you need to memorize these 8 verses, because there will be a quiz at the end, I promise.
We're not Baptists.
You what?
We're not Baptists.
Okay. All right, I'll just drop the teacher in me here. You can't really put a religion in a nutshell. I know I teach semester-long courses, you know, at Colorado College and try to do an intro to Buddhism, and you just scratch the surface, right? And it's the same in any tradition. I loved it when I got to teach world religions before I came here, because then you just had to do a couple hours on each tradition, you know? It's at least more honest, because even 40 hours doesn't do it. But I'm going to say a couple things about the Buddhist tradition. One, while it shares many, many features, wisdom, compassion, love, patience, emphasis on certain kinds of virtues, emphasis on cultivating ourselves in ways that make us overcome greed and cultivate the opposite, generosity, overcome hatred and cultivate the opposite, love, and overcome ignorance and cultivate the opposite, wisdom or insight, as many traditions do. One thing that I think makes Buddhism unique is that it has a path. It has a very distinctly articulated path that I won't go into at length because it would take years, but it's a path toward a goal that they call differently, either nirvana or bodhi. Bodhi means enlightenment, nirvana means freedom, freedom of the heart, mind, and soul at a deep level. And it is a Buddhist claim that each of us have that capacity to achieve a deep, complete freedom of the heart and mind. While Buddhists often share with Christians a notion that most human beings are complexified at a rather deep level. By complexified, I mean anger comes up easily, confusion comes up easily, pride, jealousy, hatred, these sorts of things arise in our heart without our even willing it. the Buddhists would disagree with the view that we have a kind of original sin that cannot be eradicated. And I don't wish to debate that issue because I don't know that the Buddhists are right or the Christians right. I'm just representing the standard view of the Buddhists. I know some Christian mystics as well in the tradition, which were not mainstream, believe that each of us not only has Christ-like qualities within us, but can become just like him. You know, but those Christian mystics were kind of silenced by the church that said only one man has ever been so pure, and the rest of us will always be ensconced in sin. And I don't know that that's true or not true. I just know that the Buddhist tradition has a very different view about the purity of our hearts and minds at a deep level, and a path of purification and transformation that can allow that inner light, that inner clarity, that brings with it compassion, to flower forth in a way that's really remarkable. And that remarkableness of human fulfillment or potential is called Buddhahood or enlightenment. Yeah, and the Buddhist tradition sees its founder, Siddhartha Gautama, who lived 5th century BC in India, as an exemplar of that path. But he himself says that in a lifetime, many, many millennia prior to 5th century BC, he planted the seeds for his path to Buddhahood under a previous Buddha on the planet in a previous lifetime. And so the Buddhists see this path as something that anyone can get started on once they've been taught about it, and that they even would say many Christians are on, although they might not know it. Many Buddhists are fond of saying Jesus was either a high-level bodhisattva, which means a devout practitioner, or perhaps a Buddha himself. You know, which is not to say everyone's on the Buddhist path and you'll eventually get there, which is a model that some sort of inclusivist Christians want to say. It's rather a model that suggests that there's a kind of deep freedom of heart and mind that brings with it wisdom and compassion when cultivated fully, and that all of us recognize the need for that, and that many of us are practicing in one way or another something along those lines, and I'm sure many of you here today are. When Buddhists talk about their path, I'm going to give a couple more introductory comments about the path and then dive into our text as a text that reminds Buddhists of specific skills and attitudes that ought to be cultivated on this path to awakening. The Buddhists often talk about setting a context for the path, and the context is often called recognizing that you live in a precious human life endowed with freedom and opportunity. They call it the precious human life of freedom. Excuse me, I get teary sometimes when I can talk about such precious things in front of people. They call it the precious life of freedom and opportunity, and it's a life that all of us here have. The freedoms that we have refer not just to political freedoms, which allows us to gather together today and to be able to talk about, as Don said, anything we want here. You know, it's a very affirming church. But we have other freedoms too. All of us can hear, or can hear to a certain extent. Can everyone hear me well? Yeah. Can see, can think relatively clearly, are also free from the economic constraints that won't allow you to get here. There may be some people who would like to get here from across town but can't. There may be people who have family members that don't want them to come, et cetera, et cetera. If you think about the freedoms that we have, and this is not just Buddhist freedoms, this is human freedoms, to be able to gather together and talk about important things, to have bodies and minds that are capable of doing such, to have a political system and a community that allows it and nurtures it, and to be willing and interested in doing so, is a very precious human life. And the opportunities that we have include the willingness to teach and to learn in the ways that we are now, and the fact that such teachings are available to us, whether they be Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, self-help, psychological, yoga, you name it. We have in this world precious teachings that can transform our mind and body and spirit in really profound ways. And because all of us know that, we are human beings endowed with the precious life of leisure or freedom, that is freedom from those things that don't let us study and be transformed, an opportunity, that is, we have every opportunity to be transformed. And the Buddhists have a kind of fire and brimstone chat they'll often give, and the Tibetan ones are famous for this, saying, take advantage of this life. Take advantage of it. What are you doing frittering away your time? Blah, blah, blah. Make the long list of ways we fritter away our time. Not spending an hour a day, a half an hour a day, 2 hours a day, or a few hours a week, sitting quietly, thinking how to train the mind, body, and spirit in the ways that we all know we're capable of doing. So that's a standard Buddhist message, to take full advantage of this life of freedom and opportunity. And the major path, if that's a foundation, recognizing that, the path to enlightenment or Buddhahood in the Buddhist tradition is cultivating two things. On the one hand, wisdom, which learns to see things more clearly, learns to see that we're all interrelated, learns to see that nothing stands alone, learns to see that our mind often plays tricks on us and puts veils of illusion over us so that we see each other as separate, we see our own needs as greater than that of others, and we get caught up in various ideologies from political to spiritual and on, that prevent us from allowing the full potential of love and peace to emerge in our hearts, wisdom that allows us to see more clearly what we are and what we can be. That's one hand. It's called the wisdom wing of the Buddha's path. The other hand is called the method wing. And the method wing is when we engage as skillfully as we can with those dimensions of our being, cultivating our intellect to understand the political issues, the social issues that we face, maybe learning some science to understand better human biology, learning psychology and understand how human hearts work, making money to help share it with others, learning how to understand other people's minds and hearts so that you can receive them at their level and truly listen to them, strengthening your body so that you can engage more effectively in various helpful activities in the world. This is the method dimension. The method dimension is about cultivating causes in the world that bring about more goodness. And the wisdom dimension is about clearing out the obstacles that prevent us from doing so. So they call it wisdom and method. And like a bird with two wings, one can't follow the Buddhist path, they say effectively, the path to awakening without wisdom and method. So that said, the text that I have before you today is a text that comes from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. There are many Buddhist traditions. Just like in Christianity, you have the United Church of Christ, you know, the Congregationalists, you have Episcopals, Presbyterians, and Methodists, and Evangelicals, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Southern Baptists, and then you have the Roman Catholic Church, and then you have the Orthodox Church. Buddhists have a wide variety. The Tibetan tradition in itself has four major schools. I won't go into them. These eight verses are loved and cherished by many Tibetans, and they were written by a man named Langri Tempa, Tangka, rather, a Tibetan who we think lived from, as it says on the top, 1054 to 1123. And the Tibetan tradition has something they call mind training or mental training or training the mind in Tibetan. It's lojong, L-O, which means mind, and jong, training. And it's about training the mind to see more clearly what makes us not only a better person, but what makes us happier, what makes us more fulfilled, and what makes us more effective in cultivating the kind of inner qualities that not only bring ourselves joy, but that bring goodness to the world. And from the Tibetan tradition, they isolate one skill in particular, and that's the skill of compassion. They say that compassion is not merely a sentimentally conceived notion that thinks about other people and feels sorry for them. That would be pity. Compassion is a deeply heartfelt sensitivity to the pains of living beings, including oneself, and the wish to understand the sources of those pains and to uproot them. So compassion is a quiet, still mind and body that listens carefully to one's own hurts in one's gut and mind and heart, and to the hurts of others. And they say it has to start with our own, because often the kind of compassion that is masked as pity is a pity that sees other people suffering but doesn't see one's own, and that puts oneself higher than others and thinks you have something wonderful to share with them. But in fact, you haven't done your own work, and you don't know what hurt really is like beneath the surface for you. And if you don't know that, then you're not really connecting with the other person at an authentic level. You're dealing at this intellectual level of, oh, I have some doctrine or some special thing in my mind that I want to give to you because it's my secret. But your secret hasn't penetrated deep enough in your own being for you to realize that you're really struggling with pride, with anxiety, with fear, as we all are. And so compassion needs to cut inward and outward. And the Buddhist tradition always says to start learning compassion for yourself, and by quiet sitting and listening to your heartbeat and feeling your breath and feeling your body pain and paying attention in the meditation of mindfulness. There's a common perception in the modern West that Buddhist meditation is about turning the mind off and that Buddhism is about escaping from the world. There is nothing that could be farther from the truth. Buddhist monasticism and Buddhist mental training and meditation is about turning the mind to see things more clearly so that one can engage more clearly in the suffering that exists. And many monastic traditions are doing that in profound ways. And so first we turn to look at our own issues. And once we begin to see them more clearly, we turn our hearts out and see everyone is struggling like I am. And then the mind of compassion begins to grow from that ground. In the mind training tradition, actually I'll stop there because I'll give another six paragraphs and never get to the text. Let's turn to the text. The text I'll give you that I'll read to you today has eight verses. The Dalai Lama was supposed to come to Boulder, Colorado, and to teach on this text almost a month ago, 3 weeks ago. But at the beginning of October, when he came to the United States, he saw a doctor at the Mayo Clinic, and they said, "You are exhausted. You need to rest right now." So he went back to India and rested. I found a picture online of him 4 days ago. He's fine. He was giving a talk. They did a long life ceremony and blessing for him in India, and he came up and gave a speech, and he looks really good. So I think he's resting. And I'm glad, because I'm going to India in December to see him and to see him give teachings. Some of you may know the Tibetan monk who has come here and talked several times, Ken Rinpoche, and I've often helped him teach or taught with him here. He's a dear friend of mine, and the Dalai Lama asked him about 8 years ago to build a monastery in southern India for young Tibetans to train in, and he completed it. And we helped him in this community raise about $30,000 in Colorado Springs for that monastery. And the Dalai Lama is offering a consecration blessing ceremony, and then we'll give 2 weeks of teachings on exactly the kind of topic that we're discussing today, although a little bit broader, but on the Buddhist path. And so I have the fortune of having been invited there, and I'm going to go with some friends from Colorado Springs. This text, the Eight Verses of Mind Training, is central to many Tibetan teachings, and the Dalai Lama, as I said, would have taught on it had he come to Boulder. I'm going to read all eight verses. How about that? We'll do that, and then we'll dive into some of them. I might make a short commentary on some terms that seem a little bit new to some of you, like the term sentient beings in the first line. It refers to any living being that has a heart or mind, and therefore that struggles. From a traditional Buddhist perspective, plants and trees and rocks and water are not sentient beings, although some Buddhists get a little more poetic and consider them in the broad range of our consideration. But this includes insects, birds, and also beings that many of us can't see, beings that I don't know anything about, but ghosts, spirit beings, angelic beings, beings in painful spirit realms, sentient beings. By thinking of all sentient beings as more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel for accomplishing the highest aim, I will always hold them dear. The wish-fulfilling jewel is an ancient Indian legend about a jewel that if you could find it buried in the ground and you could hold it, it would fulfill all of your wishes. It's like an Aladdin's lamp, but better. You get infinite wishes. But the wish-fulfilling jewel is an ancient Indian myth that the Buddhists incorporated in their tradition as a metaphor, and it refers to the heart of compassion. Because they say the heart of compassion is a wish-fulfilling jewel because it fulfills the wishes of yourself and others, because we are never better than when we're being fully loving. And we bring benefit to others when we're being fully loving. So it's win-win. There's no greater fulfillment than true compassion. For accomplishing the highest aim of awakening, and awakening is the Buddhist goal of enlightenment. And enlightenment is a state of being where one's wisdom and compassion have been perfected, such that one is completely sensitive at every moment to the needs of living beings and works tirelessly for them. That's the goal of enlightenment. That's what the Buddha, they say, did, and that's what I think the Dalai Lama does today. That's the highest aim. So by thinking of all sentient beings as more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel for accomplishing the highest aim, I will always hold them dear. Okay, I'll add one more sentence of commentary here. We hold beings dear, and they are so useful for our aim. If I'm a Buddhist practitioner seeking Buddhahood, sentient beings are needed for the path. I can't do it alone. Why? Because the path of Buddhahood is about achieving perfect wisdom and compassion for the sake of bringing benefit to other beings. And how can you do that without other beings? You can't. And how do you learn to be enlightened? You learn from others. You learn to recognize the struggles we all have, and you learn to see our interconnectedness. So beings are very, very precious in that sense. And you could do a cynical reading of this first verse and say, I exploit the presence of other beings because they will help me on my path. And that's one way of reading this. But what's the path? It's a path to a goal of full awakening so that one can develop the skills of serving people more effectively. So it kind of comes back to the living beings that it starts with. Verse 2. Whenever I'm in the company of others, I will regard myself as the lowest among all, and from the depths of my heart cherish others as supreme. There are many commentaries on this, and I'm going to give you a few words from the Dalai Lama's commentary, which, by the way, on the bottom you can see there's a link to it online. He has a lengthy few-page commentary on each of these verses. He's become aware through studies of psychology in the West that we have problems of self-esteem, low self-esteem, and a lot of self-hatred. There's a book called Healing Emotions that was a dialogue between the Dalai Lama and various psychologists. He dialogues with scientists often. If you're interested in those dialogues that have been going on for 25 years, go to mindandlife.org, because the Mind and Life Institute has been doing this and has published many books. I've participated in some of the Mind and Life sessions, although not with him. They do other things too. In a book called Healing Emotions, which is one of the first one, edited by Daniel Goleman, the author of Emotional Intelligence, who has been at many of these dialogues, the Dalai Lama stops the conversation in the middle with several psychologists because they use the word self-hatred, and when the translator translated it to him, he didn't understand it. And they went back and forth for 15 minutes because he couldn't understand how people could hate themselves. Well, he's learning more about our culture. And now he includes in his commentary that when lines like this say, whenever I'm in the company of others, I will regard myself as the lowest among all, it doesn't mean that you should consider yourself a completely worthless human being. Rather, you should resist the temptation you have, and many of us have, to always think that we have something special to offer others and to forget that we have so much to learn from others. That's the position or attitude that this verse is enjoining us to take on. To always remember that even the homeless person on the street, even the jerk that annoys you, if you really allow yourself to pay attention, you may not learn from them in terms of some behavior that you find ennobling or some words of wisdom that they drop in your ear, but you can learn from them how yourself reacts to such situations and how you can be more patient, more loving, more generous in your heart. You can learn from other beings, even when they're, in all objective senses, negative and lowly. You can learn how to open your heart, how to break down the walls of resistance. There's always something to learn in every situation and from every being, if we're sincere about learning and growing. So from the depths of my heart, cherish others as supreme. The third verse. In every action, I will watch my mind, and the moment destructive emotions arise, I will confront them strongly and avert them, since they will hurt both me and others. This comes from practicing quiet sitting, learning to see how emotions arise within our heart and mind. In Buddhist mindfulness practice, you first start focusing on your breath and getting awareness of your body, and then gradually developing awareness of your feelings, and then developing awareness of your thoughts. And the foundation is your body. Much of modern psychology suggests that our emotions actually start from bodily sensations. That it's not that we have anger and then our body becomes hot. Our body becomes hot, and then we recognize, oh, I'm angry. It seems to arise from the body. Yeah, and there's a practice you can do, and many of you probably do it, of sitting quietly, focusing on your breath, and feeling how your body feels, noticing from your toes all the way on up. For many of us, it's sort of between our neck and our butt that get most messed up, the gut, the heart, the back, where the precious organs are. But other places, we get twisted in our stomach and our heart. I think you know about that. Learning to see how you feel, learning to understand what the feelings are. And then when you get in social situations, you have that grounding in body and heart awareness. And you can see, oh, I'm getting agitated here. Oh, I'm getting impatient. Oh, that little demon jealousy is arising again. Here comes pride. Here comes hate. Here comes judgment. Do you know those? If we can't see them, then they sideswipe us. They push us off the track. They get in the way. So here, whenever I... In every action, I will watch my mind, and the moment destructive emotions arise, I will confront them strongly and avert them. There's an antidote to all of the destructive emotions that one learns to practice, since they hurt both me and others. Verse 4, whenever I see ill-natured beings, you know ill-natured beings, right? Annoying people, you know, angry people, obnoxious people, wrong people, people with the stupidest political views you could ever imagine. Boy, I used to do a particular Buddhist meditation on loving kindness towards others. At a certain time in our history, in the past 15 years, you can guess my political persuasion, leans kind of left, but when there were big billboards in this town the size of this wall advertising the candidacy of politicians whom I really didn't want in office, and I was angry. And I saw anger in me like I'd never really seen it before. I didn't know I had that anger in me. I wanted to, like, take out a shotgun, which I don't have, and, like, blow the sign down, which is violent and illegal, and I wouldn't do it, but the impulse was real. And I remember I had to go home and sit with that. Because at that moment I realized, in terms of how strong that energy was, I was no different from my political opponents on the other side of the spectrum, who felt the same way about something advertising my preferred candidate. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm right and they're wrong, but that aside, right? That aside... We do feel right, don't we? And that's what I mean by ill-natured beings. Doesn't matter what side of the spectrum you're on, when you feel right and you think the other person is wrong, you're not open. You're self-righteous, right? And when we see others that way, it really bothers us. Unless we really agree with them. And then we're kind of like, yeah, you know. When I see ill-natured beings or those overwhelmed by heavy misdeeds or suffering, heavy misdeeds means people doing lots of bad things. Right? They're bringing suffering to others, but they're also bringing it to themselves, although it may not have manifested fully yet. You know, the laws of karma are kind of invisible, and karma is not some impersonal fate. It's simply a behavioral, natural growth pattern in our lives, that what we think results in what we say and what we do, and what we think and say and do creates patterns of ripple effects in people, and it creates patterns of ripple effects in ourselves. We know from, you know, the neurotransmitting science that shows us that our mind is actually more plastic than we thought, right? Neuroplasticity, and everything that we say and do and think creates a likelihood that we'll be that way again in the future. We build our own future in our relationships, in our material world, and in our own mind and body each moment. That's all that karma is. That's all that karma is. It's not some mystical, weird, fate thing. So when I see ill-natured beings, people who are overwhelmed by misdeeds or suffering, they're causing themselves pain and causing others pain out of ignorance. They don't see what they're doing. They think they're bringing goodness in the world. Even if they're just being hideously selfish, they think they're making themselves better. But they don't see that it's not the case, that they're hurting others, they're losing friendship, they're getting hated by others, and inside their mind is becoming increasingly more greedy, increasingly more stingy, and there's no peace there. So rather than hating those people, to learn, whenever I see ill-natured beings or those overwhelmed by heavy misdeeds or suffering, I will cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a priceless treasure. The question here becomes why? Another question would be, why not? If you have to ask a question, ask the second one. Yeah, we can talk about that later if you have a question afterwards. 5. Whenever someone out of envy does me wrong by attacking or belittling me, I will take the defeat upon myself and give the victory to others. This is a really difficult one, and we can open this to conversation later. But think of so many situations when you want to win. Think of so many situations with people when you don't even want to win the argument, but just in your mind you want to know you're right. And you don't even say it, you don't even show it, but you know it. And what is that? Why can't we accept sometimes that someone else's point of view is just coming from a precious human being who, based on their conditioning, has this orientation towards the world now? And when we want to think we're right, we're denying that there's any rightness in what they think. And we're denying, in a sense, the preciousness of their own life. And we're shutting the doors to opening ourselves to being able to love them more fully. And we're also shutting the doors to our own capacity to grow more fully. This is a difficult one, though. I won't comment more. I'll just move on and open to some questions afterwards, if you have them. I will take defeat upon myself and give victory to others. This doesn't really mean, by the way, that you acknowledge that they won and you lose. It's a little more subtle than that. It really means relinquishing the notion that there's a winner and a loser. They might think they won, and that's okay. Let them. Do you know how painful it sometimes feels when you allow someone else to win? Do you know how much resistance many of us have to that? It's really asking us to take a look at that and whether it's really in our best interest to continue to maintain that attitude and whether it might be helpful to work on ways to slowly sand it down. Number 6, even when someone I have helped or in whom I have placed great hopes mistreats me very unjustly, I will view that person as a true spiritual teacher. Now, that doesn't mean to view them as someone who's intending to teach, but to see them as someone from whom you can learn greatly. There's a fantastic Buddhist text that the Dalai Lama quotes in his commentary on this called it's a mouthful in Sanskrit, Bodhicharya Avatara, which literally means an introduction to the path of enlightenment. It's been available in probably 6 or 7 English translations. The Dalai Lama has a commentary on chapter 6, a commentary on chapter 8, a commentary on chapter 9, and a commentary on the whole thing. It's a very precious text for him, and he quotes it often. And in this text, Shantideva, the author, a 7th century Buddhist scholar and monk, says if your goal is to practice patience in your heart and mind and to learn to overcome the seeds and impulses of anger and hatred and learn to really listen to other beings, then isn't an annoying, irritating person that you encounter not an obstacle? He says it's like if your goal is to practice generosity and you meet a beggar on the street, is the beggar an obstacle? If you set out that as a practice? So, if your goal is to practice patience and loving kindness, then how should you see an irritating human being as an opportunity? Yeah, he quotes Shantideva for this one. 7, and so what they say, by the way, what Shantideva says in that passage too, that the Dalai Lama quotes in a commentary on this, is that we should learn to cherish all of our enemies, all of our people that we see as enemies, people that towards which our mind generates hatred. I don't have a lot of hatred in my life, but I think maybe I learned to repress some of my anger. Sadly, in my middle age, it's starting to manifest a little bit. At least I can see it most of the time. I somehow get irritated more by political stuff than almost anything else. That's just who I am, you know? That's just who I am. And how to see, let's say, someone you might consider like a political enemy who holds a view not only that you disagree with, but that you think is really harmful for the world. And many of you are familiar with that. And you're familiar with that whether you're on the right or the left. People on the right think that of the lefties. They're completely ruining the world. I mean, I have a good brother who's way right and I'm way left, and he really does believe. You know, I mean, I disagree with him and I don't think he's right, but that's not really the issue, right? He thinks as I do, that the other side is harming, right? And so that the other side is an enemy. I have a good friend from high school who once told me over dinner with beers, well, you're my enemy, so I don't know if we should get into this conversation. I said, what do you mean enemy? Because I'm a Democrat? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, oh my, stop. But we often do think that. So how can we see someone who thinks very differently from us, even if we think they're harming the world, as in a sense our teacher? Because one, we can learn about where they are, what they're thinking, understand their humanity. Maybe if we just want to be sort of instrumental, we can understand their humanity so that we can skillfully help change their mind. Okay? If you could do that, great. Okay? But not just that. To really open up so that the barriers and the darts of hatred and coldness don't emerge in us. At least to be able to love them as they are. Verse 7. In brief, directly or indirectly, I will offer help and happiness to all my mothers, more on that in a moment, and secretly take upon myself all their hurt and suffering. They often say all my mother beings. That refers to you guys and me. All of us are mother beings. Why? Because whether you take it literally or you just want to imagine it as a thought experiment, the Buddhist tradition urges us to imagine that each of us has had past lives, and we've had many past lives. We've had so many past lives that every single one of you has been my mother in the past, and I've been yours. And to hold that imaginative vision in mind when you encounter other living beings, in church, on the street, at work, and to look at every being and think, well, he doesn't look like my mom now, but before this lifetime was my mother, and as my mother, held me in her womb for 9.5 months, nursed me, wiped messy stuff from every orifice of my body, fed me, protected me, taught me how to speak, gave me the skills to become a mature individual. And as many human beings we know from psychology feel towards their mother and their father when they get old and die, especially after they die, they feel, I never fully repaid their kindness. So they say to look at all beings as having been your mother, having bestowed tremendous kindness upon you, recognizing that you never fully repaid their kindness, and recognizing now's your chance. Here they are. How do you repay their kindness? By taking your spiritual practice seriously. By engaging with them as precious human beings. By trying to cultivate the skills of wisdom and compassion that allow you to see how interconnected we all are. How important it is to open our hearts in patience and generosity and kindness and care. And in that way, you return the kindness to all your mother beings. That's a traditional Buddhist line that's depicted here in verse 7. In brief, directly or indirectly, I will offer help and happiness to all my mothers and secretly take upon myself all their hurt and suffering. That's also a complex line, and the Dalai Lama offers a long commentary on that. If you want to go to the website, I'll show you. Some of you may have heard of a practice called Tonglen, T-O-N-G-L-E-N. There's an American Buddhist nun. Her name is Pema Chodron, and many of her books are quite popular. I know many non-Buddhists read them and find them rich and nurturing. If I had to pick one, I would recommend... I can't remember right now. It'll come to me soon. Anyway, it'll come to me soon. She has many, many books. And she teaches in many of her private public teachings and in her books this practice of Tonglen, which means giving and taking. And it's a visualization practice where you quietly sit and imagine the pain of another being, maybe a loved one you have, a parent, a child, a friend, a dog, doesn't matter. And look, imagine they're in front of you, imagine their body, their mind, their pain. Think of a specific struggle they're having physically, mentally, relationally, financially, doesn't matter. And understand that they, like you, hold that pain within their being. And to cultivate a sense of care for them that wishes them to be free from their suffering. And you imagine their suffering leaving their body in the form of a light fume or a smoke or soot. And you breathe in through your nostril their suffering into your own body. And imagine as it goes into your body, it touches your heart, and that your heart is a flame of love and compassion. And as that soot or smoke touches your heart, it dissolves in the flame of your love. And then as you breathe your out-breath, you allow your own warmth and peace to touch them and ease them. And so you do a circle of in-breathing their suffering, transforming it in your heart, and then breathing out your own peace of mind and love back to them. And imagining that it touches them and heals them and softens them and gives them peace. It's not a meditation that the Buddhists say is necessarily really going to help someone or heal them. Who knows, it might, but they don't advertise it that way. They say what it does do is it heals you. It goes against the grain of our heart and mind, which always wants to take our own needs as primary and the needs of another as secondary. And it opens our pores, our channels of sensitivity. And as a visualization practice, it really grounds you in imagining how deeply connected you are with someone else when you care for them, and how you wish that their pains would come into you, and that your understanding could transform them so they won't stick. They won't stick on you. And you transform them through your own love, and then you send back peace to them. And to imagine this is something that when you imagine it regularly, that practice itself not only gives you peace in body and mind, but when you practice it, it becomes a little bit second nature. When you're in a situation where someone's suffering, it eases your resistance to that suffering. It eases the degree to which you feel pained by their suffering and you don't want to open up because it's overwhelming. You do that practice and you just take it in and let it out. And it really opens things up for you. And it allows you also then to be with that person, especially if it's an irritating person, an annoying person, who you know is coming at you from a place of some ignorance or envy or anger, and you just breathe it in and let it out. It allows you to be with them in a place of stillness so that you can really listen and be receptive and maybe respond from a place of care as opposed to reactivity, this Tonglen practice. That's what it means here at the end. I will secretly take upon myself their hurt and suffering. To do this practice, to allow other people's suffering to become your practice. To become your practice. In the tradition, they'll say if this meditation is too much for you because it overwhelms you to feel like you're taking on someone else's pain, then they say don't do it. Just think about, oh, I wish they could be happy, and don't bring their thing into your body. But if you're looking for ways to deepen your compassion and sort of help to melt down the barriers you have towards others, then this practice can be really, really helpful. That's verse 7. Lastly, verse 8. I will learn to keep all these practices untainted by thoughts of the 8 worldly concerns. May I recognize all things as like illusions, and without attachment gain freedom from bondage. He shifts here because it's the last verse, and I can't go on at length on this one. But I will learn to keep all these practices untainted by the thoughts of the 8 worldly concerns. The 8 worldly concerns are what are considered 8 ways in which our mind pulls us away from effective spiritual practice. And the 8 are 4 pairs. The first is being concerned about praise and criticism. That is, being really happy when you get praised and being really upset when you're criticized. They would say, for example, if in giving this talk I have any concern at all about wanting you all to like me or praise me, then I'm being tainted by a worldly concern. And I'll confess that little ego thing manifests in me at times. That's who I am. But I'm on guard and I try to think about it a lot. And it's helped me in the past 20 years or so. You know, if I see that thing coming up, I just go, shut up. It doesn't matter whether anybody likes you. You know, it's like you could have 8 billion people like you and still you wouldn't be happy. So, David, stop it. It's not the source of, you know, peace that you're really looking for. So to be really concerned about praise and criticism, I wrote these down in case I forget, success and failure. That is, it's okay. If someone praises me, I'll say, thank you. That's really nice. I'm glad you like that. Like, to have a little joy in your heart, it's great, but not to, like, really look for praise all the time and to really be PO'd when you're criticized. Sometimes when you're criticized, that's really good, right? Have you ever been criticized and realized, whoa, I need this. I don't only need to be humbled, but I need to learn. Yeah, it's really important. And praise sometimes can be very harmful. If you have a strong ego and you hold on to it and you start carrying around how good I am as a feeling within yourself, walking around like you rule the world, you know? So criticism also, you can get a really reactive ego to it. But sometimes someone is criticizing you wrongly, but that's okay. Accept it. If you disagree, disagree calmly, but not to get upset about it. That's praise or criticism. The second one is success or failure. Doesn't mean you shouldn't smile when you have a success, but that not everything in your life should be about always having successes and not having failures. There was that famous talk Steve Jobs gave maybe 6-8 years ago when it was a Stanford graduation, and he talked about all his so-called failures in life. And he said they weren't failures at all. They were just one door closed. You know what I mean? He said, I'd made a lot of effort for something to happen, and it didn't happen. Now I got to do something else. You know? He says this whole idea of failure really sort of sits in our mind and blocks us. It obstructs our capacity to work more freely and generously and energetically in the world. Success and failure, those are the second two. Of the 8 worldly concerns, there are 4 more. Wealth and poverty, that is to be concerned whether you have a lot of money, a really nice house, really nice car, or whether that stuff starts to diminish in your life. Now again, this is not about saying, you know, you don't need a roof over your house, you don't need a car that runs well. I do know, I now have a car that runs well, and I have had times in my life when I didn't. It's really nice, you know? Yeah. It's nice to have a reliable car. But how about when your car breaks down? Or when you can't afford to have a good car, which happens to people? And then you let that sink into your sense of self-worth? I don't have a good car. Well, okay, you don't have a good car. Pardon? You got a bike. You got friends with cars. You got a bus system. Or if a good car is that important to you, then figure out a way to get one. But to sit there thinking, I don't have it, or I don't have the money, or I don't have the, right? Not to be so concerned about it. If wealth comes, use it well. When it disappears, use what you've got. If you need more, then get it, but not to be so concerned with whether you have or don't have, which many of us are in our culture. And this comes from an ancient Tibetan text. They thought the same way. They didn't have our excesses of materialism, but every human culture has it. We shan't romanticize. Lastly, fame on the one hand and lack of recognition on the other. Yeah, whether you really get recognized publicly for all your good works or whether you don't. Who cares? Well, a lot of us do. Why does it really matter? These are the 8 worldly concerns. Praise and criticism, success and failure, wealth and poverty, fame and lack of recognition. I will learn to keep these practices above the first 7, untainted by the 8 worldly concerns. When I see them coming in, hammer them down. Like at the festival, the carnival, you know, you got those little bop sticks that bop down those things that pop up. I forget what they're called. Pardon?
Whack-a-mole.
Yeah, whack-a-mole. Yeah, whack-a-mole on the 8 worldly concerns. May I recognize all things like an illusion without attachment, gain freedom from bondage. This could take months to elaborate on these last 2 lines, but let me say that the first 7 verses and the first half of the 8th verse are what are called relative or conventional Bodhi mind, that is developing compassion in the world through all these kinds of practices. Then there's something called ultimate Bodhi mind or ultimate practice, and that is learning how to see the nature of everything clearly and to be free of illusions. And that's a deep mental wisdom that I don't have time to get into today. In fact, I think I should probably stop because we have only about 5 minutes left. So I've been through the 8 verses, and I think maybe right now I'll just stop then and see if you all have some questions or comments. Please, sir.
I'm looking at this number 2, number 3, number 5. In Christian tradition, we talk about, sins of commission and sins of omission. And there's a saying that says, if good men do nothing when faced with evil, evil prevails. And I'm wondering, in Buddhism, I don't see a call to action when we see evil things occurring. And I'm wondering if there is such a call, and if so, how should it manifest itself?
Yeah, the call is there, although there's no term evil in the Buddhist tradition. And of course, I think personally that's not a helpful word. Yeah, I think we often, you know, everybody defines that in their own way. Buddhists would consider it causing harm to others. That's what the call to action is about. Whatever sort of intention, mentally, or verbal action, or physical action, brings harm to living beings, one is called to seek remedies. The remedies are often, though, deep down inside, in the heart. And so the Buddhist tradition urges one to learn how to see one's own evil, if you will, but many of us don't think that way. Maybe a better Christian term here is sin, right? Sinfulness, right? Evil tends to be like some really bad stuff out there, you know, Satan and Saddam and all that kind of stuff, right? To learn to see the sources for negativity. And while we seek to find those sources in our heart and eradicate them, we also, out of compassion, want to stop them in the world. And if we can't convince someone that their way of acting in the world needs to stop, then by all means, engage in legal and other remedies to stop them from hurting others. That's always in Buddhist texts. We want to try to stop sources of suffering and to confront them, but never, if possible, with hatred or with a mind of superiority, but always out of compassion. These texts, though, don't emphasize that kind of socially engaged mode, but it's there. Yeah.
There's a tension and a need for balance that I experience, and I think I hear in what you're presenting, David. On the one hand, when negativity or most cultures, destructive emotions, the billboard with the shotgun, when a negative part of ourselves gets aroused, I hear on the one hand that we are to be inquisitive and curious and compassionate and to see where that's coming from and see what we can learn, which I agree
yes.
with. And on the other hand, in line 3, I will confront them strongly and avert them. And that, I think there's a place for that, but it's risky. So could you comment on how one balances those two approaches?
Yeah, the term avert here is translated differently in other texts. I don't know the original Tibetan. I prefer not avert. There are other ones about like applying an antidote or something like that, applying a remedy. Avert suggests like avert your eyes, to turn away from them, to repress them. So the Buddhist approach always has the 2 wings that you mentioned, or the 2, whatever the metaphor here should be, prongs. One, just paying attention, seeing it. Seeing it for what it is without initially judging it. Wow, I've got an
incredible pride here. What is going on? What, or jealousy here? What is going on? And this jealousy seems like it's like about to tear my heart apart. You know what I mean? This is not a helpful emotion. What can I do to ease it, right? Then applying something to ease it. And there's a lot of different ways in which the Buddhist tradition talks about it. For example, in the case of jealousy, learning to see. Let's say you have something I want. You've got that nice Lexus I always wanted. And I'm like, I see it, and I'm like, damn, I just got a little Subaru. I really want that Lexus, all right? And then to think, David, you can't afford the Lexus, so just stop. Why cause yourself the pain? Intellectually, you can go through various modes of reasoning to stop it. And so to get ways of sort of allowing that energy to desist. I think that's what the avert means, but there are methods that one applies, and they never involve turning your head the other way or pushing them down, but finding ways to allow them to self-destruct using reasoning, using meditation that tries to apply an antidote, or just allowing yourself to sit until you realize this is just stupid. I've got to let it go. In some Buddhist traditions, there are prayers to, you know, imagine beings that you ask to take it away from you, kind of in a theistic type mode. So there's a variety of methods. Anybody else? Yeah, sir.
Can you comment on what's happening? And I think it's Myanmar, where the Buddhists are showing violence against minority. Are they missing the compassionate way?
Yes, they're practicing violence against minorities and they're racist. It's that simple. And they're Buddhists, or they claim to be. It's that simple. They're bad Buddhists. It's really happening, and it's terrible. And there's Buddhist violence in different countries in the world.
How do they justify it then?
I doubt they do with any Buddhist logic. They just drop their Buddhist self and they go out there and talk about how bad the other people are. They might selectively quote scripture. Have you ever heard that method? But they can't justify it using any kind of sound grounding in Buddhist thought. It's impossible. It's violent racist behavior. And it's happening in Burma. It's really sad. Yeah. Please. Yes.
I didn't hear.
She says some of the language in the text, which says, I will take the defeat upon myself and give the victory to others, doesn't quite seem appropriate in this situation. Let me know if I'm saying this rightly. Where someone is really being abused and harmed and hurt by others, whether in an individual relationship or by some social structures. Yeah, no, it's a really good point, and I don't think this is very applicable in that situation. This is assuming that someone has as a foremost commitment in their mind this kind of spiritual practice. And there are certain things in one's life which might make that spiritual commitment secondary or tertiary because you have these primary needs.
It's an immediate
need. Yeah. And in that case, you know, you do what you have to do. Hopefully you'll remember, I'll try not to be violent. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's this wonderful passage Daniel Goleman wrote, I think in the book I quoted earlier, Emotional Healing, and Healing Emotions, or maybe it was elsewhere, about a psychologist he knows who was treating a Tibetan who had been in prison for 20 years and had been suffering under unbelievable violence. I mean, electric cattle prods placed in every orifice of the body, starvation, beating, I mean, you know. Many died under those circumstances. He was able to get out. And he was brought to the West, and he was given to psychologists to cure his PTSD. He had no symptoms of PTSD. All the clinical trials showed none. And when a psychiatrist finally asked him, what were you most afraid of in prison? He said, I was afraid that I would lose love from my captors. Now, that might just be a sweet story somebody made up, but Daniel Goleman said a psychiatrist who met the person told him that, so I believe it. It's pretty impressive. It suggests that there are some people who really do have that spiritual practice as their priority and nothing else will get in the way. But granted, most of us aren't there yet, right? I don't think I am. And so the tradition in general will recognize that there are other needs that sometimes come into play. So at the most, if you can avoid harming others, then try to protect yourself by all means. And that would be the advice. That would be the advice I would give to anyone in a situation of abuse and pain. Protect yourself. Have compassion for yourself. Yeah, absolutely. Don't just take defeat. If someone's beating you verbally or in any other way, you know, you deserve better. Yeah, that's the fundamental principle here of compassion in the tradition. That wherever harm is happening, to seek to avert it, to seek to dissolve it. In the case where we have the spiritual practice and the spiritual strength to allow it to happen, when someone else is hurting me physically or verbally, if I have the capacity, I can let it go. I love that. There's a guy named Jesus that did that on the cross, they say. You know? Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I think that's an example, if he really said that, and that was the situation, of immense love and compassion. Right? He wouldn't strike out at those people and didn't want anyone else to. You know? Although he was an unusual case. In a variety of ways. Maybe one last question? Well, what should we do with time? Where's Don? Don, if some people have to go to the next service, should we let them go and let others stay to chat? How should we manage?
Unfortunately, in my opinion, it's time to do that, but that means it's also time to give a nice...
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you all.